A year ago, Egypt and Syria, Iraq and Jordan were threatening war against Israel. The Israeli government had announced the near completion of the Jordan Valley Water Diversion Project, and the Arabs threatened that if the tap was turned on, their armies would march. This spring, the irrigation pipes began to draw the waters of the Galilee southward into the Negev. And General Nasser's threat proved to be sheer bombast and empty. Now those diplomats and writers who delight to sweep political dirt under any convenient carpet breathe more easily. And they were quick to write learned articles to the effect that the Near East was grumblingly, to be sure, coming to an impasse, to a begrudged coexistence. They drew an analogy to the current thaw in the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States. But in this case, the wish was father to the analogy. The Near East is closer to war today than has been at any time since the Suez Crisis. The Arab leaders are determined upon it. That there is no war as yet is simply due to their determination to be more careful in their planning, in their preparation. When Nasser hurled his threat a year ago, he had very little to back it up with. The three crack divisions of his 130,000-man army were committed to a bloody and protracted war in the Yemen against a deposed royalist regime and its Saudi Arabian allies. His UAR partner, Syria, was restive under his leadership and was recuperating at the moment from one of its endemic and periodic coup d'etats. King Hussein of Jordan had just foiled an assassination plot against his own person, a plot mounted by Nasser, and Nasser could hardly count upon him for political support. The time was not propitious to unloose the Egyptian army. Nasser, a political realist, a consummate political realist, Nasser rattled his sword not so much to foretell and predict what he actually was going to do, to rattle the diplomats of Washington and London. Whenever before he had threatened war, some of these who were scared and oil concerned would come running to Cairo, and they would promise a negative vote against Israel and the United Nations, or some subterranean economic sanction against Israel, or failing that, at least an increase in the economic and military aid which America and Germany and Great Britain give periodically to shore up the always shaky Egyptian economy. This time, the West was not to be manipulated. Nasser had been to the well once too often. Besides, the Israeli course was entirely proper. King Hussein had already drawn from the Jordan River large amounts of water for his East Ghor irrigation project. An irrigation project which had been sponsored by, financed by, and manned and staffed by the United States. A project which had been drawn up in accordance with a water allocation scheme devised by our ambassador Johnston in 1954. The United States was now morally committed to the Johnston quotas. And the Israeli Jordan Valley scheme was drawn up entirely within the terms of this earlier pact. Besides, Washington had in the past several years become increasingly disenchanted with Mr. Nasser. And there was good reason for it. In the last 12 years, we had poured $2 billion of aid into the Egyptian economy, and we had precious little to show for it. His army was staffed with Russian sergeants and staff officers. It was equipped with Russian supersonic fighters and Russian missiles. His vaunted neutrality was increasingly malevolent. He was flirting with Peking. He had brought pressure on the King of Libya to force the United States out of our extensive and expensive Air Force base at Wheelis in Libya. He was financing commando raids by Bedouin tribesmen against the British in Aden. He had interfered in the Yemen in a revolution which was none of his business against our good counsel. He refused to adjudicate adamantly any of the outstanding issues between Egypt and Israel. And he was peddling his revolution throughout the Near East, in Iran and Iraq and in Syria and Libya, even in Algeria and Morocco. There were active Nasserite groups sowing trouble and practicing assassination. Washington, to be sure, had gentle conversation with Israel. If Israel would delay opening the irrigation pipes, an ugly international incident might be avoided. But Israel was strong in its position, and Washington had no alternative but to announce to Nasser that Israel's position was correct, that the United States reaffirmed the position taken by President Kennedy in 1960, that we were opposed to war or to the threat of war in the Middle East, and that we would look unkindly at any act of aggression which violated existing boundaries. Nasser learned in 1963, a year ago, that he now lacked the leverage to go it alone. So he determined on a new scheme, one which would involve all of the Arab states from the gates of India to the western shores of the Atlantic. He learned in 1963 that he could not expect indefinitely to draw upon the fear of Western diplomats. So let them be afraid of the entire power of the Arab world. Western diplomacy is fixed on the balance of power in a Cold War. Surely they will see it our way, the Egyptian way, when we threaten them with the loss of the goodwill, of the loss of even the neutralism of the 13 major Arab states of the world. And so Nasser convened in Cairo in January of this year, and again in Alexandria in August of this year, a pan-Arab summit. The war in the Yemen drags on. Saudi Arabian troops are fighting Egyptian troops. Nevertheless, King Faisal and King Hussein, the leaders of Iraq and of Iran and of Syria and of the Lebanon, of Morocco, the Sudan, of Algeria and of Tunis, of Libya, came together in Cairo for a single purpose, to plan, to organize the final destruction of Israel. The Arabs call it the liberation of Palestine. And this time there was to be no haphazard attack. There was to be a well-planned, well-conceived military program. Now, there have been other attempts at pan-Arab union. You remember the Arab League from before the Second World War. Most of these plans have been sheer propaganda designed to frighten the West. Is this true in this case? Perhaps. But for the first time, there has been established in Cairo the equivalent of an Arab Pentagon, bureaus and offices with a single purpose, to coordinate all military action against Israel. For the first time, there has been established a political weapon, which the Arabs believe will negate the American position that no borders are to be violated. How so? A Palestine government in exile is to be created. Its citizens presumably will be the Arab refugees who have been so carefully kept apart and segregated by the Arab nations. This Arab government in exile is to be presented whole with an army. The army is to be equipped with Russian weapons provided by Egypt. The army is to be staffed by leading officers from all of the 13 Arab nations. The army's mission? Now, infiltration and assassination, and later, the ultimate destruction of Israel. And when this army marches, Nasser confidently assumes that the oil-conscious diplomats of the West will accept the rationalization that these people are not crossing any external border, but merely entering a land which is presumably rightly their own. Is this Arab unity scheme merely another piece of Arab propaganda? Perhaps. But for the first time in over 20 years, Nasser has found the means of financing his army in the field. He has convinced the oil-rich nations, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq, that they can finance this scheme without cost to themselves. How so? All they have to do, he's told them, is to add a small royalty surcharge to their next international contract with the oil companies. Every gallon of Arabian gas which we use up in our cars will be paying the cost of this organization for murder. More than this, the military machines, the defense forces of Iraq, Jordan, Syria, and of Egypt are to be put under a coordinated command. They are to be equipped with similar weapons. Their officers are to go to a single staff college. Their bases are to be inspected by a single officer corps. These are to be the backup forces for the Palestine Liberation Organization. Once the border has been crossed, these are the armies which will crush. And $100 million, $100 million has been pledged by 8 of the 13 Arab states to the cost of this military operation. There is no war in the Middle East now, in the sense that there is no actual fighting. But for how long? How long? Now, there is much that is disturbing and a great deal that is shocking in this pan-Arab conference. Yet as I read about it in our papers and heard it discussed by our statesmen, I was surprised to find that most assumed any other reason but it stated its purpose for its call. The Arabs made no bones about it. The Cairo summit had a single purpose, to squash Israel, to erase the Jewish people from Israel, to erase Israel from the face of the globe. Yet in the learned press we read of the need to establish a government exile to gain another seat at the United Nations, of the desire to get a better bargaining position vis-a-vis Israel in the inevitable bargaining over the Arab repatriation policy. And some even went so far as to say that the fighting Arab warlords needed a convenient mask so that they could come together without loss of face to adjudicate their bitter and ugly fratricidal disputes. All this may be true. But I would remind you that Hitler wrote Mein Kampf 12 years before he came to power. That hate very rarely masks its ultimate objective. That Nasser has never once masked his ultimate objective, genocide. The destruction of the entirety of the issue of Palestine. Let me read you his call to this conference. The whole Arab nation, peoples and government, met at the beginning of this year at the summit conference which was held in Cairo for the sake of Palestine to proclaim to the world at large that the Arabs are united in facing their enemies. The first summit conference came as the beginning of our action, determination, and resolve. We in Cairo are now preparing for the second summit conference to follow up this action. We will continue to follow it with all our power until Arab soil has been purged of imperialism and its stooges, and until Palestine has been liberated from the clutches of Zionism and becomes an Arab country again. This objective is no longer a mere hope cherished in our hearts, nor is it a slogan included in our aspirations. It has become a bounden duty for which we must prepare ourselves. We must make full use of our scientific potential, of planning, of our armed strength. We must concentrate on winning public opinion. This will never be achieved with slogans, but only by action. for which alone the first Arab summit conference met, and for which purpose the second summit will assemble. It is to this end that all of our energies and all of our resources have been mobilized. There you have it. A call to jihad, to the ancient to-the-death crusade of the Arab Bedouin. That such sheer malevolency should exist in this day and age, out in the open, is a stunning and shattering fact by itself. Even more stunning and more shattering to me has been the acceptance of these summit conferences as another political meeting by the press and the diplomats of the West. This was not a convention of diplomacy. This was not a meeting of statesmen. This was a horde of jackals come for a bloodletting. Here were nations, 13 nations, all members of the United Nations, all presumably committed to peace and to the international arrangement of existing disputes. There were 13 heads of state, intelligent men, modern men, come together for a single purpose: murder, destruction. And no one saw outrage. And no one thought it was damnable, and no one shouted, purge these people from the United Nations. Throw them out, excommunicate them from the body of Western nations, peace-loving peoples. We will have no truck with such as these. No, this was simply another group of men come together in political purpose. It was accepted. I'm often asked, Rabbi, how is it that you who preach a gospel of peace, that you do not preach pacifism? How is it that you do not argue for unilateral disarmament? Here is my answer. As long as there are Nassers in this world, and the Nassers of this world, my friends, are not limited to the Near East, as long as there are Nassers in this world who use labels, who speak of peace only to grab for power, there must be a deterrent force. For these are not reasonable men. These are not men of goodwill. These are devils incarnate. These are not men who can be treated with, but only restricted, imprisoned, forced. To withhold their arms and their ambitions. Will there be war in the Middle East? General Al-Nasser has his way, there will be war. Of course, this Arab summit will have its full measure of problems, of organizational difficulties and more. Arab unity is notoriously fragile. It has never lasted more than a year. Perhaps he cannot keep it fixed even on this single focus of hate. We do not know what will be the role of Russia. Russia, which has backed every one of Nasser's narrow ambition this past decade, which has provided Nasser with the most advanced and sophisticated of weapons. Will Russia be willing to endanger its own security by catalyzing war in the Middle East? A war which can, in an hour, escalate to an atomic worldwide holocaust. Nor do we know what reception the nations of the world will give to this cheap piece of political maneuver, the chicanery, the establishment of a Palestine government in exile. Perhaps it will be dismissed for the patent fraud that it is. We do not know. But this much is certain. We are closer to war in the Middle East than we have been in the decade. Events there have taken a dangerous and ominous tone, and there is nothing to be gained at all by sweeping this political fact under the carpet. What's for it, then? The single greatest deterrent to Nasser's ambition at the moment is Israel's defense force. It is a strong army, His will is certain. In the past 2 or 3 years, it has been enabled to buy the most advanced of weapons. Until 1962, only France among the Western nations was prepared to sell to Israel the necessary balancing weaponry. But as Nasser has increasingly stepped beyond bounds even acceptable to our State Department, first our own government in the sale of Hawk ground-to-air defense missiles in 1962, and later other nations of the West have allowed Israel to purchase such military equipment as it required. The Israeli Defense Force is a strong one. It is the strongest army at the moment in the Middle East. But do we not deep down recognize that brinkmanship and deterrence are only short-term solutions? What's for it then? In the first place, the United States must cease to sponsor Nasser's ambitions. Now, we have learned these past 5 years not to sell or give military weapons to General Nasser. We found these weapons in Algeria. We found them in Iran. We found them in the Yemen. We found them in the Sudan. We found them in caches in Gaza about to be used against Israel. We have learned that Nasser has no intentions to use such weapons as we give him in the Cold War against our Cold War enemy. But we have not yet learned that every dollar of aid, whether it be in foodstuffs or whatever, that we give to Nasser, allows him to transfer another dollar into his military budget. Nasser's economy is known to be shaky and uncertain. And yet this man, whose people live as abysmally as those of any semi-advanced nation of the world, spends $1 in every 7 of the national wealth of Egypt on arms. $1 in 7. Where does he get the money? From West Germany? London? From Washington? From Moscow? And counterpart funds and foodstuffs for peace? Every shipload of grain which comes into the Alexandria harbor allows Nasser to shift this many dollars from one budget to another, from one pocket to another, and he need therefore spend that much less on his own people. Why should the American taxpayer be financing the political ambitions of this megalomaniac? Why should a man who is unwilling to spend the national treasure of his nation, which is threatened by no other nation, for the welfare of his own people, why should we undertake a concern for their welfare? What's for it then? A clear and patent restatement by the United States and by the Western allies. We will not look kindly upon the threat of force in the Middle East. That we will, by our actions, both within the United Nations and without, guarantee the borders, the present legitimate and legal borders of the Middle East against aggression. And that we will not allow ourselves to be befuddled or bemused by artificial political chicanery. We do not recognize and will not recognize the government in exile. Israel's land is Israel's, granted to it by the United Nations in 1947. We recognize its integrity, and we will bestir ourselves if any take aggressive action, any, against Israel. Now, this has been, in large measure, the position of the United States government. President Kennedy said as much in 1960. The State Department reiterated at President Johnston's orders late in 1963. And this is the message that President Johnson himself gave to Prime Minister Eshkol when he visited Washington in July of last year. It's been said, why then do I feel that it must be restated? It has been said, but it has not necessarily been heard. Experience has taught General Nasser that the United States means what it says sometimes. In 1954, 1954, you may recall that Secretary Dulles was determined to avoid an arms race in the Middle East. He got the consent of all of the Western allies, all of our NATO partners, to an arms embargo, which would cover Israel and all of its near neighbors. General Nasser's response was to sign a secret arms purchase treaty with the Soviet Union. The very arms began to come into Egypt, which were uncovered by the Israeli Sinai campaign 2 years later. The United States responded to this bit of Machiavellian maneuver. How? By continuing the arms embargo, which now worked unilaterally to Israel's disadvantage, and by doubling the amount of foreign aid which General Nasser was to receive in 1955. Yes, the United States means what it says, some of the time. In 1956, after the successful Sinai campaign, Israel was pressured by the United States to remove its troops. The United States assured Israel that it had the assurance of General Nasser that if the troops were removed from Sinai, the free passage of Israeli shipping would be guaranteed through the Suez Canal. This was only according to international law, no more, no less. Under this promise, given this pledge, Israel withdrew its troops. In the intervening 9 years, not a single Israeli ship has been allowed passage through the Suez, nor any single Israeli-bound ship of any flag. And the United States' response to this withdrawal of a commitment by Egypt? In 1957, we doubled our aid to Nasser. We have brought no effective economic or political sanctions or pressures against him. Yes, the United States means what it says, some of the time. In 1962, we come closer to our own day. The United States advised Mr. Nasser we would look at it as an unfriendly act if he intervened in the revolution which was then going on in the Yemen. General Nasser intervened. What was a local war became a matter involving the entire Near East. We continued to send to General Nasser $200,000 of foodstuffs every 3 months, a significant sum, because it's estimated that during those early days of the war, Nasser was spending $200,000 every 3 months on this military adventure. We did not propose sanction in the United Nations. We did not take any determined diplomatic action against Nasser. He has known for a long time now that the United States means what it says, some of the time. We vacillate. We vacillate between a concern for principle and peace and a concern for oil and our presumed geopolitical interests. In 1963, the United States Senate, by an overwhelming majority, attached a sense of the Senate rider to the Foreign Aid Appropriations Bill to this effect, that no further aid of any kind should be granted to Egypt until the right of free passage was guaranteed through the Suez, until Egypt had withdrawn its armies from the Yemen. And our State Department announced the next day that it would not be bound by this sense of the Senate resolution because, quote, it was not in the best interests of the United States. Yes, the United States means what it says, some of the time. There is an urgent need now for an unmistakably clear statement by this administration which reaffirms the integrity of current boundaries in the Middle East, which reaffirms our determination as a peacekeeping measure to guarantee the integrity of these borders within the United Nations, or failing that, unilaterally without. The United States has a long and wonderful history of friendship with Israel. We've engaged with Israel in many economic developments of all kinds, most lately in a fine program conceived by President Johnson to develop water desalination projects of all kinds. The United States has reason to be friendly to Israel. Narrow reasons, political reasons. Because Israel is its one certain friend in a turbulent part of the world. Israel is the one country which is a democracy. Israel is the one nation which knows the value of freedom. Israel is the one nation which has voted consistently with the United States at the United Nations. Israel is the one nation whose people fought with the Allies in the Second World War. Israel is the one nation whose people can be counted on to be loyal to our Western philosophy. We have been friendly to Israel, and we have had reason to be friendly to Israel. And we need now to make clear to the world that we will not tolerate any military maneuvers or political maneuvers which are determined to erase this friend of ours from the face of the globe. Will there be war in the Middle East? There may be. The Arabs are determined on it. The jackals have gathered. They smell blood. Scavengers are ready to pounce. But there need not be war in the Middle East. Israel is strong and will maintain, God willing, her strength. And there is, thank God, an increasing awareness in our own nation and in the free nations of the West that the future of Israel is in large measure a concern of all free peoples, and that they must now bestir themselves, all interest to the contrary, to guarantee and to support in peace this noble experiment in democracy that is Israel. Will there be war in the Middle East? We pray, all of us, that there will not be.